Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with film historian Janine Basinger about Hollywood marriages.
I don't know that Hollywood was telling us anything coherent about marriage. They weren't exactly experts in the area.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Charles McGrath explores the wonderful humor of P.G. Woodhouse.
Syntactically, this stuff, it's like some finely tuned engine. And there's this brilliant mingling of high and low, and even the slang. In his hands, it still kind of works. It's amazing.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Pretty girl.
Yeah, she's a very nice type.
You got types?
Only you, darling. Lanky brunettes with wicked jaws.
Janine Basinger is one of America's most admired and best-read film historians. She has a new book. It's called I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. It's reviewed for us by Judith Newman, who says that Basinger is one of the great film gurus, and her book is wonderfully insightful. I'm delighted that Janine Basinger is joining us from South Dakota, of all places, though she normally teaches at Wesleyan University. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, I have to start with two words that to me, say, I'm an old movie buff. Now, I don't know remotely what you do, but I'll mention two words and then you just tell me what they mean. You ready?
I'm so ready.
Myrna Loy.
Oh, yes. Well, obviously they mean the perfect wife. But they also mean beautiful actress with a great deal of talent and often noted for her beauty and not so much for her acting ability. She was really a great person for acting with the wonderful stars of that era. She could adapt beautifully to any co-star. But the perfect wife, that would be her her little nickname.
And why, Janine? I'm thinking of films like, oh, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, or The Best Years of Our Lives, and also the great Thin Man series. She's so charming and attractive. She's probably every man's ideal image of the perfect wife. And you study these things very closely. What are the attributes? What sets her apart?
Well, one of the things about Myrna Loy is that women also like the idea of her as the perfect wife because she's like a great role model for all of us who are nagging away and getting up with our hair a mess in the morning, you know. I mean, she always looks great, and she manages to nag by merely lifting a little eyebrow from time to time. Myrna Loy can forbear. I mean, she's no doormat for any man that she's playing opposite, but she manages to just suggest this guy needs to shape up and get better with just a little bit of a smile, a little lift of an eyebrow. She does all the things that we real-life wives have to do by just killing and yelling and screaming, you know, and still remain elegant. Of course, she's beautiful, she's classy, but she gives you the sense that she's fun. She's the fun mate for a man, and she's the fun mate we women would like to be. So what it is with her is she's always half of some kind of dream marriage, the ritzy good one we all thought we were going to have.
Now, let me ask you about an actor who strikes me as being maybe unsurpassed, you may disagree, in the role of husband, and that's Spencer Tracy.
I think Spencer Tracy is absolutely the counted upon, reliable, insightful, steady on but not dull, ideal American husband. And he's also something else which I think is significant, the ideal American father. You know, I can remember when I saw Father of the Bride, I knew I was never going to be Elizabeth Taylor, but, you know, I thought, man, think of having a father like Spencer Tracy. He'll spend all his money on you. He'll do anything for you, and he loves you unconditionally. He's husband and father, so he really nails down a very broad area of reliability in terms of image where women are concerned.
Now, Janine, let's broaden this out and look at some larger cultural messages. You've mentioned two ideas that apply, or two traits that apply both to Myrna Loy and Spencer Tracy, and that's a kind of remarkable forbearance. Was Hollywood telling us something about what family life should be like?
Well, I don't know that Hollywood was telling us anything coherent about marriage. They weren't exactly experts in the area. And I don't think that they thought their job was to really tell us what we needed to know. I think what they thought their job was to get our money at the box office and send us out happy so we'd come again. But I do think they wanted to connect to something that they thought we believed. And the message in the long run on marriage really had to be, stick with it. It's all you're going to get. You know, stick with it. Forbear. Go with it. Endure. Survive. Go back to the drawing board. If it breaks apart, reassemble it. And, you know, that makes sense for an audience that was coming in, you know, to see something that would entertain them, and an audience for which, for many decades, marriage really was the main event of their lives.
And Janine, over time, let's look at more recent movies. You write about, for instance, Kramer versus Kramer. Now, for some of our younger listeners, that will seem an old film, but it really comes out of the post-studio era. How have, in general, depictions of marriage changed over time in Hollywood films?
Well, Hollywood has to follow the sort of main market trend of society. So as marriage became less required, I mean, you could live with someone and not be married to them. You could live with someone and not have children with them and not be married. You could live with someone of your same sex and conduct a marriage with them. Everything changed. It was no longer required. Hollywood films begin to reflect that kind of thinking. And ultimately, you come to see films taking up social issues of that sort. More divorce, more women leaving their children with the husband, a few more gay couples, not many, but just a sort of a different attitude. You introduce elements like sperm donors, things that, you know, weren't available before. But interestingly, the bottom line of these movies is really very similar to what you had when you started out at the beginning, which is marriage is a kind of vast mystery. It's a journey that you start out on with someone that you think you know, but you may not know. You're going to encounter a great many internal issues that are going to divide you, separate you, challenge you. And then there are going to be external ones like wars and social changes. And so, you know, it's all kind of comes down to the same kind of lesson, which is you have to solve the mystery of your own marriage. You have to accept your partner and find a way to negotiate. And you have to endure the problems that all marriages have faced, which turn out to be in movies kind of the same from the beginning till now. You know, money, adultery, class differences, incompatibility, my favorite one, murder. I love the idea that a really normal plot idea for Hollywood movies is one mate is trying to murder the other. You know, isn't that fabulous?
Well, Suspicion, for instance.
Yes.
And Janine, how skilled were the old studios back, you know, to the golden period of the 30s and 40s at casting husbands and wives? Did they really have a good sense of which actors and actresses were right and how audiences would respond to them?
Yes, absolutely. One of the great strengths that Hollywood had was in locating stars, defining personas for them, finding out how people saw them, and then putting them together in pairs. It is a very challenging process. I mean, sometimes a couple, say Bogart and Bacall, who really had great chemistry and loved one another and married each other, show that chemistry on screen. Other times, the Lunts, for instance, don't show that chemistry on screen, and neither, in my mind, did Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. It doesn't always show up, but it will show up between two people who aren't married, such as Walter Pidgeon and Greer Garson or Mr. Rogers. But Hollywood paid attention to the sparks that came on screen, not off screen, but on screen. And they listened carefully to audiences. When audiences picked up on a couple, believed in them, liked them, wanted to see them together, they continued casting them as a romantic pair and frequently then as a married pair. And, you know, that's just one of the great sort of wonderful geniuses of the system, really.
And is Hollywood, which is so different now, it's atomized and there's so many different independent studios, but are they still as good at that kind of thing as they used to be?
We don't see couples being paired in 8 and 9 movies together. Where we see that phenomenon is more on television, where you get a simpatico couple and you believe in them and they work together over a season and then a second season and a third season. The business is so different now. It's very difficult to make those connections because a studio doesn't have stars under contract, and therefore getting two people together again becomes more challenging, more expensive. There's so many issues, don't you think?
It certainly makes sense to me. You know, I'm thinking of a pair. Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner were good for a while, but that was really more a romantic couple.
Yes, although they play in a really devastating marriage movie called War of the Roses.
Oh, yes.
In which the battle of the sexes literally takes up arms. You know, it goes nuclear. I mean, they really do go to war with one another, and that's quite amazing. But they're a good pair, but it doesn't seem to last as long. But what we do know is the old Hollywood was very good at it. And remember, a film like The Thin Man could be made, shot in 3 weeks, and then edited and gotten out to the public very quickly. So they could put a pair together several times in 1 year, keep them in front of the audience so that the audience really did grow to love them and believe in them as a couple. It was a whole different system then.
Well, it's also fascinating, and you illuminated so well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. A lot of fun, and I hope people will enjoy reading the book.
That's Janine Basinger, whose new book, I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies, is reviewed in this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is All the Rave, The Rise and Fall of Sean Fanning's Napster by Joseph Menn. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes in the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
So in addition to the Pulitzer Prize, there's a prize Pulitzer. Who is she?
Well, Lisa Pulitzer, who is a ghost author of a type. Her name appears on books, but she specializes. She specializes in young women who have escaped cults, an odd subgenre of some popularity.
Okay. Is she often the, as you say, the ghost writer or co-author of these books?
Co-author. She has her name is on the books, often in smaller type.
And she's written a number of these?
Well, she has two out right now, one on the bestseller list, Beyond Belief, She's got another one coming up called Banished, which is about the escape from the Westboro Baptist Church. And she has a bestseller from a few years back called Stolen Innocence, about a woman who escaped from an extreme Mormon sect. She was married off at 14.
How did she get into this particular area?
She started out working for the New York Times on contract. That is, she wasn't fully on staff, but we would pay her to chase crimes, essentially, out on Long Island. And she was there in the late 1980s and 1990s, which was a heyday of odd suburban crimes.
We're not talking about Amy Fisher, that period?
Yeah, that period, sure. But the one that she really got involved in was Joel David Rifkin, who was a serial killer, possibly killing off as many as a dozen or more prostitutes out there. She was covering that, working very hard, but then she got pregnant and decided she couldn't be at the courthouse and got hired to do a quickie book. So she did crime for a while, but then she was called in by a publisher, as they will sometimes do, and asked to audition for the book about the woman breaking out of the Mormon cult.
Now, what do you mean by audition? Do publishers actually try the ghostwriter or co-author out?
Yes, it's a little bit surprising, but they call you up and they don't say, you'd get this job. They say, we are asking three writers, go meet with the person who has the story, and whoever she likes will get picked. Now, Lisa, as a mother, understood this girl. She's very motherly, which is, I think, why these girls who have had very bad experiences with their own mother or have had to break with their own mothers to leave cults.
Now, Leslie, you're saying girls, so we're talking about young women, quite young women.
We're talking about, I call them girls because I'm getting old, Sam, but they're women who are old enough to break from their cults. So they are over 18.
Okay.
But
still
very young.
They
were raised in the cults.
Raised
to me, I call people under 25 very young.
No, this is fascinating because it's an extraordinary act of courage and independent-mindedness to do it. They're actually raised in the cults and then decide to break away from it.
Absolutely. It is an actual act of incredible individual-minded thinking.
Did Lisa Pulitzer tell you what particular skills or, I mean, you've mentioned one to relate, kind of empathy required to tell this kind of story?
Well, she's empathy, but she also has her own, she thinks the girls relate to her, young women relate to her, because of her own family saga, which her father was Bert Pulitzer. He was a best-dressed man. He was a fashion designer, but he left their home quite early, and she had a very rocky childhood. Her mother was depressive, would disappear for days at a time. There were lots of step-parents coming in and out of her life. So she felt she relates to these girls on a deeper level. You know, as she said to me about one of the girls, she said, Jenna had, you know, three mothers. I can understand what that means.
Now, did she take you inside her writerly process at all? I mean, is it very long interviews? Then she separately just drafts a manuscript or chapter by chapter, shows it to her collaborator. Did she give you an idea how that works?
She did. With each of these young women, it's very different. Some of them want to take a stab at writing themselves and often bring hundreds of thousands of words to the table.
That they've written.
But in most cases, it's a very intense process where she takes extensive interviews, sometimes waits as much as 2 weeks to sort of think it all through, and then writes. She writes these books. One of the things about these books is they're in the news. So she turns these books around, hold on to your pants here, Sam, 4 to 6 weeks.
Oh, my gosh. So she's in training. We don't want to overdo this now. But she's in training to be like another Joyce Carol Oates or Stephen King here.
Oh, my goodness. It's very impressive.
And did she give you any idea, Leslie? This is a question readers often have, and students. I do a bit of teaching. Once she's finished with the book, do we know or have any idea whether she maintains a relationship with the subject, or is she on to the next one and the next story?
I did talk to her about that. She does maintain a relationship with several of these young women who need mother figures, but they're complicated relationships, as you might imagine. A lot of these young women don't really have skills for mastering the world, and they sort of fall in and out of her life. But she did, for instance, go wedding dress shopping with one of them who's getting married because she wanted to support them. She does stay in touch.
Do we know, did she tell you what they think of the book? Do they read the book at the end and say thumbs up or thumbs down, or this isn't the way it really was, or this isn't me, or do they seem comfortable with the final result?
I interviewed all three girls, and they're all happy with the final result. They were very involved. You've got to remember, you have the writer who goes back and forth, and sometimes she actually puts it up on Skype, and they'll look at it together as she's writing it.
Puts the manuscript, the text up on Skype.
Right.
Fascinating, right? So they'll edit.
They will. Yeah. And on several occasions, the young women mentioned to me that she went to bat with them on the publishers. The publishers would say, oh, we can't put this in. It's going to be libelous, or we can't put this in because, you know, we have no verification. And she went to bat for them. She also went to bat for them on language, where the publisher made the language fancier than these girls, many of whom have not been educated. And she's gone to bat so it sounds like them.
And do we know finally, Leslie, how she is compensated? Is she paid a flat fee? Does she get royalties? Do we have any?
She takes a piece of the advance and then gets a piece of the royalties.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
P.G. Woodhouse is one of the most beloved and funniest writers of the last century. He's subject of a great biography, and now, Collection of Letters. It's called P.G. Woodhouse, A Life in Letters, edited by Sophie Ratcliffe and reviewed for us by my esteemed predecessor, Charles McGrath, who is a contributing writer for The Times. Welcome, Chip.
Thanks.
So you love Woodhouse.
I do. Yeah, I always have. It's going back to when I was a kid. It's just, and I keep Woodhouse by the bed, you know. It's like sleeping medicine.
Does he make you laugh now?
Yes, he still does. I mean, the thing is, he's a great writer. I remember once I had lunch with William Shawn, the great editor of The New Yorker, and Shawn told me, he astonished me by saying he thought that Woodhouse was the greatest pure writer of prose he had ever read, which kind of bowled me over. And it's kind of right. I mean, it's syntactically, the stuff, it's like some finely tuned engine. And there's this brilliant mingling of high and low, and even the slang, this old Brit slang, old bean and chat. It's in his hands, it still kind of works. It's amazing.
So what about the letters? You say he was much concerned with money. At one point, you say he was probably the best paid writer in the world.
Most highly paid writer in the world, I think almost without a doubt. He was making a lot of money selling the stories to Saturday Evening Post and the Colliers. And he was also making a lot of money in Hollywood. He was making a couple $100,000 a year in Hollywood as a rewrite guy. And that's when a couple $100,000 a year was money.
He was a Broadway guy, too.
He was a Broadway guy. People forget that. He wrote about 40 shows, mostly with a guy named Guy Bolton, but he also worked a little bit with Porter, a little bit with Gershwin. He was a go-to guy on Broadway. And he had this amazing facility with lyrics, and you know, apparently a lot of these shows have been lost now. But he could turn out a lyric, you know, in 20 minutes. You needed a song, he'd give it to you. You know, he wrote some of the songs for Showboat. Bill is a P.G. Woodhouse song.
And what about his life?
Well, as I say in the review, he didn't really have one. He wrote all the time, except the one sort of strange chapter in his life was when the war broke out. He and his wife
World War II.
He and his wife were living in the south of France. And Woodhouse was such a political naive that he didn't see war coming. He's writing in his letters, he's saying, there's not a chance of a war. There has never been less of a chance of a war than now. So they didn't get out in time, and the Germans captured them. And Woodhouse was sent to an internment camp in Silesia for a while. And while he was there, he agreed, and this was a scheme the Germans cooked up, he agreed to make a series of radio broadcasts, not to Britain, but to America, where he had many fans. And the broadcasts, which the transcripts are still around, you can read them. They're very funny. And they were meant to be lighthearted and to assure readers that he was well.
So this isn't Ezra Pound.
No. He makes fun of the whole experience. He says, well, people ask me, how do you get into an internment camp? He said, well, the first thing is you get captured by the Nazis. It's all in that kind of frame of mind. But this did not go down well. When word got out in Britain that he had done this, this is when the Blitz was going on. And he was thought then, he was compared to Lord Ha-Ha, the traitor. And he never recovered. His reputation was so bad that basically he exiled himself to America where he died. And so that's the one strange chapter in his life. And the letters, I have to say, throw a kind of disturbing shadow on it. I had always assumed, and most people had, that he was just a political naive and that he lived so much in a world of his own making, a kind of interior Blandings castle, that he just didn't get it. The letter suggests something more than that. As I say in the review, it borders on a kind of moral stupidity. He really treated the war as a personal inconvenience. The letters he's sending back from Germany show no inkling or for the lives that are being lost on both sides. And while the war is going on, he's negotiating with the Germans to make his books into movies, which seems a little tasteless.
And was anybody telling him not to do this? Or don't we know? I mean, he's in prison.
Well, he's not in prison at this point. He's in Berlin, and no one's telling him not to do it. And I suppose you have to allow that he's not getting good information. He's not communicating to England at all. So whatever information he's getting from America,
which was not involved in the war for a lot of this time.
That's right. So, but there is, as I say, he's not just naive, or he's naive to a point where it's almost unforgivable.
And what about the last years then? You say it. These particular letters, cast a shadow on him. There was an estrangement between him and his homeland. Did it affect the writing at all?
No, that's the amazing thing. I mean, he wrote some of his best books during the war, and then he just continued to turn them out. And he went a little bit out of fashion as time went on, but not that much. His audience remained, and he was just a machine. And he turned these books reliably. You know, there was a book a year and a collection of stories, and it was all at very high quality, right up. He was working on a book when he died, and he was in his 90s.
And he was a real craftsman, too, you say.
Absolutely.
Very careful,
very
meticulous rewriter.
Rewriter. And you see that in the letters. The letters are not as funny and entertaining as the books. It makes you appreciate what went into the books. There's a whole other level of craft and care and detail and even rhythm of sentences and so on. And so you see by subtraction, I suppose, what his genius really consisted of.
Thanks so much, Chip.
You're welcome.
That's Charles McGrath, my distinguished predecessor, contributing writer for The Times, who reviews P.G. Wodehouse, The Life and Letters, in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on our many lists this week?
Well, I'll just cover two. On the hardcover fiction list, there are four new books. At number 14, Dana Stabenow has a book called Bad Blood. It is set in Alaska. It is part of a series she's written about an Aleut private investigator named Kate Shugak. And Stabenow herself was born and raised in Alaska. She was actually raised on a 75-foot fish tender off the coast of Alaska. And she said that her first stories as a young girl were about a girl who lived a normal life on shore. And she presented them all to her mother.
What's a fish tender?
Oh, it's a big fishing boat that processes fish after they come in. Then at number six, Joanne Fluke, a bestseller list regular.
Right, Joanne is no fluke on our list.
She's at number six with a book called Red Velvet Cupcake Murder. She writes these culinary mysteries about a small-town Minnesota baker. A lot of small-town mysteries on the list this week. That's the Dana Stabenow in Alaska. That's Joanne Fluke in Minnesota. It's also at number two, Jody Picot has a new book called The Storyteller. Not so much of a mystery, actually, but a New Hampshire baker. So a small town baker's on the list this week. This is a bit of a departure for Picot, who usually writes kind of ripped from the headlines, current events stories. This instead is a Holocaust story. It's set in the present day, but it's about the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor who gets to know a concentration camp guard in her town, and he kind of confesses to her and seeks her forgiveness. And then new at number one, J.D. Robb, who is actually Nora Roberts, writing in futuristic police procedural mode, has a new book in her In Death series called Calculated in Death.
And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, there are three new books, all written by professional reporters. At number 16, John Thavis, a longtime reporter for the Catholic News Service. He was their bureau chief at the Vatican.
Well, that's quite a beat.
Well, and he's got perfect timing. The book is called The Vatican Diaries. It came out 10 days after Benedict XVI announced his resignation. And so this book has gotten a lot of attention for its timeliness. He's really looking at kind of the recent history and politics of the Vatican. Then at number 13, a couple of reporters for the Boston Globe, Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, have written a book called Whitey Bulger, looking at the life and capture of that famous Boston gangster. And then at number one, the New York Times reporter who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010, Michael Moss, has a book called Salt, Sugar, Fat, which is looking at the junk food industry and sort of building a case for the junk food industry as akin to the tobacco industry, saying that the big food companies intentionally load up their foods with salt and sugar and fat to make them more addictive.
Now, Greg, in your excellent column this week, you look back at an interesting hiatus in the history of the bestseller list and the New York Times Book Review.
Well, what's interesting is it was a hiatus for the book review, but not for the bestseller list. In 1963, actually starting late in 1962, there was a newspaper strike in New York, the 1963 newspaper strike. It lasted all the way through the end of March. So it was a good almost 4 months, 114 days. With no major newspapers in New York.
Right, a heavily unionized industry, and everybody went on strike.
That's right. It started, I think, with the printers, and then the Newspaper Guild itself got involved. And I think nine major dailies in New York all stopped publication for almost 4 months.
And you describe in your column how that was not great news for some very consequential American authors who had books coming out at more or less that moment.
Not only American authors. 1963, the first quarter of 1963, which overlapped exactly with the newspaper strike, saw the publication, the U.S. publication of The Tin Drum, Günter Grass's first novel. It also saw the first U.S. publication of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which I think was his first book. It also saw the first U.S. publication of Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange.
Some big titles.
Big titles. Books that have just gone on to become huge classics were all published in those first 3 months of 1963. So it was a very big time in publishing. There was very little publicity for these books because suddenly all the major outlets weren't running reviews. There was no book review. There was no daily paper. There was, however, the New York Times had a Western edition, a short-lived experiment had launched before the strike started.
So we mean like California.
Western. Yeah, we do mean California. It printed Weather for Los Angeles and San Francisco. It was a stripped down version of the Times. It was only about 18 or 22 pages long. And it kind of gathered the best of articles from the Times. Any articles it ran, I suppose, were written by scabs or freelancers, people who were willing to write even during the strike. But it also included the bestseller list in a shortened version from what would regularly appear in the book review. So even though there were no reviews and even though there was no book review during that time, there was still a bestseller list during the newspaper strike.
And Greg, you also describe how the book review played some catch up with some of these important books.
Yeah, the book review came back on April 7th of 1963, was its first day of publication after the strike ended. And Francis Brown, the editor at the time, had a big front page kind of roundup that was headlined, "A Lot Happened While We Were Gone." A lot happened while we were away. It was something along those lines. There was a cartoon over that showed a kind of despondent, bearded man slouched in his armchair, and his wife was saying to him, "Cheer up, Harry. You're not the only author who came out during the strike."
And also, as some of our listeners probably know, it was the newspaper strike of 1963 that really opened the door for that August new publication.
The New York Review of Books started in 1963 in direct response. I suspect the idea had been kicking around for a while, but suddenly it left a window open that nobody was covering books. So, hey, here's this new publication to come in and do it. And by the time the newspaper strike ended, the New York Review of Books had built their circulation to like 75,000 just in those few months because people were so hungry for the missing coverage.
Well, it's remarkable. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
And now for something special. John Williams, come over here and join me for a second. So I'm now talking with my colleague, John Williams.
Hi, Sam.
And listen, we're pretty proud that something called the Plain English Campaign in England, which has been around for 40 years, has chosen the New York Times Book Review podcast as the best podcast of the year.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It's pretty fantastic. And you and I talked about this when it was happening, and we both agreed that we think we're nice guys, and Greg's a nice guy too, but there's somebody else who really deserves this award.
Yeah, we do our best. But the real beating heart of this thing is Jocelyn Gonzalez, our esteemed audio producer.
And so we're going to ask her to join us. Jocelyn?
Okay, come on over, Jocelyn.
Wow, I'm not usually on this side of the mic.
Well, Jocelyn, this is our chance to kind of publicly acknowledge the extraordinary work you do. And when I got this email, however long ago it was, and shared it with colleagues, everybody said, well, that's really – it's nice that they sent me the email, but we know who's responsible for this. And so I told them that. So they sent us both a prize. And so
very
tell
nice.
Us a little bit about what you do in the course for a week. First, we'll tell listeners that you are there at the computer recording us and adjusting the levels. But talk about the editing you do. I don't think people really get that.
Well, the editing is sort of like, gee, I don't know what it is. I find it very meditative, actually, to go through a whole interview and sort of sculpt it down into what people hear every week. We do take out things for length, and then we can move things around so that the topics flow better. But that's basically what I do, and I try to do it in a way that it sounds like it just happened that way, but we know that often that it didn't.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I remember early on, and I don't think we're tattling on anyone here, but when Rachel Donadio was our first Notes from the Field reporter, because she was the Book Review's first and maybe really only ever in-house reporter, she was terrific, and she really started this whole segment off. And it might seem at times that Rachel was going off on a tangent or something, especially as we're all getting used to this. And you told me once, don't be fooled, that her reports were almost made to be shaped and edited, that you could pull whole sections out. But what about times when there isn't that much there? How do you then – I've never heard anyone say, well, that guest you had – didn't illuminate anything or didn't share any information or seemed so closed-mouthed. What do you do when you don't have a lot to work with?
That's tough. You really have to go through the interview and find threads that can be tied together. Sometimes you have to create those seams. And it really helps when the person has little ticks. This is like a weird technical thing, but I'll save breaths and I'll save when people go, because we tend to do that when we're going to change topics. It's sort of a vocal signal that I'm thinking and about to lay something new on you. So I look for those in the way that people speak, and I actually use those sometimes as transition points because that sounds natural. If I were to just, you know, let something leap like that, you know, from one topic to another without including the vocal tick, that would sound like a jump.
Now, Jocelyn, today we had what we call a remote interview with Janine Basinger, who was terrific, who was in South Dakota. So we had to do it on the telephone, and then we're both wearing headphones. What are some of the complications with those interviews?
A lot of times it's the landline versus the cell phone line. The cell phones tend to get a lot of interference from something else. And we're using what they call a POTS line here, POTS, in the old radio lingo, that's plain old telephone service. So we're using an analog telephone line, and both your voice and her voice are coming back and forth on the same line. So what we're doing behind there is trying to make sure that when you overlap, you don't feed back on each other. And so when she's talking, I bring down your level. When you talk, I bring down hers. So I'm actually mixing it live as you guys are talking.
You know, Jocelyn, one of my favorite interviews was with really one of America's most extraordinary artists, the great composer John Adams, who's a brilliant book reviewer for us. And he actually approached his editor via email. He lives in Berkeley, David Kelly, who's our deputy now, and said, I really like this podcast. I'd like to be on it. So remember we had him?
Wait,
from,
really?
Yeah, yeah, that's what happened. And do you remember how attentive he was? He would say, okay, so I have to be sure not to step on you. And here we are dealing with like one of the maestros of human sound.
Right.
And he was so attentive to the professionalism we aspire to hear. Do you find that guests seem to give a lot of what they have when they come here? Because you probably are used to kind of reading people. How many guests that come in seem not into this at all to you?
You know, I don't think that's happened in a long time. I think when we started, we definitely had people who were inexperienced with media. And I think that a lot of the authors coming in, a lot of the reviewers, they're sort of like more attuned to the way they present themselves online, on television, on the radio. And I don't feel too much anymore that people are nervous or don't know what the mechanism of doing an interview like this is.
And now for a big global question. Here we are doing a podcast. You began in radio. You were involved in important programs. Is this where radio is going? Is this now state-of-the-art radio?
Oh, my God. It seems like it. There's been a big resurgence in podcasting. If you take a look at public media, there's a lot of really successful podcasts being launched with Kickstarter campaigns. And they're beautifully produced, and they have great staff and really interesting topics, and people are taking care with how they're produced and how the stories go out. So the fact that we've been here this long, slugging away, I feel really proud that we're still doing it. We're doing it well. People are now asking to be on the podcast, which didn't used to be the case because these used to be hard to book, you remember?
Yeah, I remember very well.
What? How do I get it? What is it? Is it the radio? It's like, no, it wasn't any of those things.
And Jocelyn, is there a time, you know, I tell people, authors particularly, when they come in to do the show, and I say, well, Jocelyn's going to edit you and you will sound even smarter. And then I tell them that Jocelyn does exactly what we do as editors. She's going to, you know, move copy around or move the sound around, make sure things are in the right order, that they sound better, bring out the actual quality of the guest's voice. Are there times when you say, all right, we've got to listen to six of these in a row and see what we can improve or see if we're falling into bad habits or repeating ourselves? Do you ever listen to it and say, I did not edit that as well as I should have? I miss that thing.
I do second guess sometimes. The great thing is that I know that when I send it in, I know John Williams is going to listen to it with eagle ears, and we definitely have a double check on it to make sure that we don't have any errors or I left in a mistake, which I have done. So, you know, John's our safety net, thank God. But there's definitely times when I thought, like, I'm not sure if I made that leap in logic correctly with the editing, or maybe I should have stepped in and had you re-answer the question. But when I started doing this, I think the charge was don't make this sound so manufactured. There's so many things that are packaged within an inch of its life that are out there, and they sound really concocted. And I don't think we ever wanted this show to sound really manipulated. It's a natural conversation. We're hanging out. We love the authors. We love books. We're all fans. And that's the vibe I hope the show has.
Do you remember, Jocelyn, when we first went on to QXR, and some listeners will remember that the show was slightly kind of streamlined and tightened to put it on a particular radio slot, 15 minutes.
Wait, we were the lead-in to the
To the prayer service.
That's right.
Or something. And Temple Emmanuel, I think. But we began to hear from listeners who thought it had gotten kind of slicked up. Do you think we're back to our more kind of free-form style now? And I think we did learn something from doing that. But do you prefer this approach here?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we learned from doing such short program before was how to control the interviews better, you know, right here at the recording stage, to know when a guest was going off and how to bring them back in. But I know that people definitely like this longer format. I like it. It's more relaxed. We have people writing in saying they want it even longer.
We do?
Yeah. I've definitely heard that. The great thing about doing the podcast is that we don't have that boundary anymore where we have to stay inside the lines of 15 minutes or 8 minutes or anything. Things can be as long as they need to be, as long as they're still feeling good.
Well, Jocelyn, congratulations. We'll congratulate ourselves.
Yes, I pat you on the back. You pat me.
And it's so great to talk to you, and I think it's a treat for our listeners, too. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.